From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, one of the Milwaukee 14 remembers the day 50 years ago when he and others broke into a government building to burn draft records.
We did there. We sat around and we're singing songs and prayers. And then eventually the police came, the fire trucks came. And they just basically handcuffed us, took to the county jail.
Later, Dan Fogelman's TV show, This Is Us, is a critical hit, but his new movie has not connected with audiences, and our film critic is curious why.
Life itself won't be the greatest movie any of us will see this year, but it's far from the worst as it cleverly zigzags through the stories we tell to and about ourselves. And it has an A-list cast that rises to their roles.
And why a Milwaukee actor has taken it upon himself to educate us all on the life and work of writer Carl Sandburg.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. 50 years ago this week, a group of people broke into a downtown Milwaukee government building. Their mission was to grab as many military draft records as they could and burn them in protest of the Vietnam War. They were termed the Milwaukee 14.
Bob Groff was one of those 14 people. Today, he's still in Wisconsin and is a retired educator and community organizer. Groff sat down with Lake Effect's Mayon Silver and talked about what set the events of September 24th, 1968 in motion.
Well, there have been other actions before us, a major one being Catonsville 9 in Catonsville, Maryland. And Dan Berrigan, Phil Berrigan, and a number of people we knew were involved in that. So out of that action, it came the planning for this one here. So the people in Milwaukee were from all over the place. I was at Casa Maria and heard about it through the Catholic Worker, and I went out to the retreat out east, and I became a member.
How did you start associating the 14 of you?
Well, I was in the Jesuits the year before, and for 7 years, and I started getting involved in St. Louis and the peace movement and stuff. And so it was a gradual thing, working with the poor and needy. So I came to Milwaukee. I was around Casa Maria Catholic Worker House, and I was active with students in Milwaukee. At that time, it was very active days. We did a lot of organizing. In Marquette, it was a big movement in Marquette against institutional racism that year. And so when I left the Jesuits that summer, it was just sort of a natural flow of my life.
And how did the target of the Vietnam War come about for the Milwaukee 14?
Well, in those days, that was the main war. Now we have 7 or 8, but it was the main war, and there was a lot of opposition all over the country. So it was a question that came up when I was in St. Louis about what was that all about. And in those days, we studied both sides, and then we took action. We believed that in those days that we could change things, and I think we did it somewhat, but we could change things. And that was the same with civil rights. I was involved with civil rights activities here in Milwaukee, Father Grappi and the marches. So we really believed we could make a change, and we did sometimes.
What happened on September 24th when you got caught because you had had press at the occasion and you were burning the draft records and then the police showed up? What happened after that?
Well, you know, we did there. We sat around and we're singing songs and prayers. And then eventually the police came, the fire trucks came, and they just basically handcuffed us, took to the county jail.
What were some of the immediate legal consequences?
Well, legal consequences, we were charged with burglary, arson, and theft at the time. And we were put in county jail, and we were given a high, high bond by Judge Seraph at the time. And so we were there about 30 days before we could make bond. So we were and then later on, the legal consequences, we were also tried. We were prosecuted on the federal charges, but 12 of us went the state route, and then the legal consequence was we were tried, had a jury, were convicted, a burglary, arson, and theft, and served, given 2 years consecutively in the state prison, which some of us got paroled after a year, and I was one. We were sent to different places. I happened to spend most of my year at the Waupun Maximum Security Prison.
Did that give you an insight into the prison system?
Yes. I had been sent to a farm from there, and I was sent back, and I was upset about that. But I just felt it was better to be there with people that were really been a long time. And that's how I started the Independent Learning Center school with some other people. There was kids that were in trouble, and we were trying to get an education. They were kicked out of school. We're trying to get education for them. I started a school with Don Cotton, another member of the Milwaukee 14, and another young woman that was at the time who was working with unwed mothers. They were being kicked out of school too. But that part of that was because of my. After that, I couldn't protest too much. I had to do something more concrete, and I did that after I got out, because I met with people that were there for serious crimes and had a whole life story to tell. Why I was there was a joke, burning draft records. It was a joke, but it was good because I really appreciated understanding that and had a real passion for jail and prison reform ever since.
Did you have any regrets after serving that sentence or during of the sentence?
I think we expected longer. In some groups, there was a number of actions after ours, maybe almost 100, and some people got longer terms and some people got out, So there was a whole series of, call it Catholic left or priest nuns, lay people, movements all over the country. Some people coming this weekend, next week, are from the Chicago 15, which was another action. A lot of people in Milwaukee were involved. There's all kinds of them afterwards. As a movie actually we're showing Sunday is called Hidden Stay. It's about all the actions that came afterwards and before. And it's there was a tremendous movement that lasted all the way until the draft finally was ended in 73. And the war was ended about the same time.
Do you feel like the burning of the draft records made a difference?
At the time, because at the time there wasn't computer systems and there wasn't electronic breakdown. So all the people whose files were burned were able to get out of the system draft. All they had to do is move. And the time they got caught up with them, they didn't know where they were. And in fact, we got letters later on. I didn't realize how many people did that. And letters later on, 20 years later, thanking us for that. And I don't think that was, immediate in our mind, but it did work out that way.
What was immediate in your mind?
Well, we were trying to take a stand against the selective service system where people were forced to kill or be killed in the war. And we were taking a stand against the Vietnam War, which that was feeding at the time. We were in one war. And it was a major, universal protest of that war. And it finally ended about the time the draft ended.
What are some of the protests that you think have been successful since the 70s? And do you feel protesting has changed since then?
Right. Well, in Milwaukee, the Coalition for Justice about Dontre Hamilton, one of our speakers is Marie Hamilton Saturday. And I was involved in that, and I thought that took direct action. We went to the streets almost every day in March and got some good results at the end. The training for police officers was finally changed, and they got sensitive training now for people with mental illness. And they got some justice for the police officer. He was fired. So I think that the movements like that, not too many of them. The Black Lives Matter is a good example of things that happen. And like Dontre Hamilton was part of that, maybe. What I have too much of is all these petitions and electronic media. You text people, you call the senators and congressmen, you go to talks about this, and you go to talks about that, and now we have 25 groups. But there's no action. There's no fire in it. And so we get more of the same. You know, we have liberals and Republicans all voting for this tremendous military budget, $718 billion this year. And I think just that's – I think we've got insensitive to it, and we don't have the sense that change happens with direct action. We have the sense that change happens if I write senator or a call or I go to this talk. I've been – you know, I go to some of them. I'm not against all these things, but nothing happens. It got worse. We have – I said we have 8 wars going on right now. We only had one. And then we have more talks and more petitions, and we have more wars and more military spending. Military spending is outrageous right now in this country, in the arms, the sale of arms, that what's going on, and the support of people like Lockheed Martin by our Congress people is ridiculous. And so people are suffering greater numbers of deaths in Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq, all 8 different countries were at war right now, and yet there's less sense of it. You know, we feel we can change by, you know, writing a letter or going to a rally or going to a talk. It's not happening. It's getting worse.
So what is the type of direct action that you would get behind?
Well, some of us are involved in trying to get Marquette to not host the military. Right now, Marquette hosts 3 departments of defense, the Army, Navy, and Air Force. Navy and Marines are together. And they actually do the training on campus, and they for all the kids from UWM, from schools in Kenosha, Carthage College, everywhere comes to this military base. And here's a Jesuit Catholic university teaching war and killing. One of the Jesuits that was involved, Dan Berrigan, involved in the Cadenceville 9 and other actions, he said it's schizophrenic to think that you can teach values, gospel values, and killing at the same place. So I'm involved in stopping that, but we're not too successful because we don't have the numbers anymore. One time in the 70s when Marquette, when we were active, we had thousands of youth fighting institutional racism in 68, fighting ROTC, 70. I have pictures of that days. It's not anywhere close. Right now, they have groups and they talk and they, you know, sign petitions. And we don't really feel we can do much about it right now.
But I do what I can. How would you aim to bring that spirit of 1968 and the 9 violent direct action to today?
We're trying to remember what we did. And I think there's a lot of people doing a lot of stuff. Some people who can't make it this weekend are in jail in Alabama for stepping on the Trident Center and doing some symbolic damage there. They've been in jail since March, and they got a ways to go. So there are people doing stuff all over the country. We just don't hear about it. In certain circles, Catholic workers' circles and stuff, we hear about it. But we don't hear about it, so I try to be a part of that. And there's hope that we can get more of a spirit that we had before, that we can make a difference by doing things, not by violent direct action. And that's what I'm trying to encourage.
Thank you, Bob Graff, for speaking about this event.
Okay. You're welcome.
Bob Graff was a member of the Milwaukee 14, a group of 14 people who were arrested and charged with burglary, theft, and arson for breaking into a government building in Milwaukee and burning draft records 50 years ago this week. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver.
And that was, I don't want to call it ancient history, because 50 years ago wasn't really all that long ago in the grand scheme of things, but it's history. Right now, in the present, there's what we call a transition. We are into the second day of our fall member drive, and we're working on making sure that we have the listeners and the members, the sustaining members that help make this show possible for years to come. So why don't you play a role in making this fall member drive a success by calling us now, 414-227-3210, or where can they go online?
They can go to wuwm.com/give. And And we are looking for 10 members this hour during Like Effect. So anyone who also contributes this hour is automatically entered to win a 3-book collection of biographies that have been featured on Like Effect. I know one is probably the young George Washington, an interview which you did, Mitch.
Right, exactly, with a Wisconsin native, a Milwaukee area native named Peter Stark, I believe is his name. And interesting book about the George Washington that existed before the George Washington that we all read about in our history books. Also, two other really interesting books, all three of them are books that have been featured on Lake Effect in recent years.
Yeah, and a contribution is not required to enter the drawing, but it is always appreciated because we are, of course, in the midst of our fall member drive, and it's the members of Milwaukee Public Radio that make the programming you hear today possible. So once you call 414-227-3210, or you can go online and make a secure donation at wuwm.com/give.
A quick break now, and then our film contributor offers his thoughts on why a new release from Amazon Studios is performing well below expectations. This is Lake Effect on listener-supported WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues here on WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The third season of the hit NBC show This Is Us premiered this week. The show's themes of life, loss, and family have captivated television audiences in vast numbers.
It's also boosted the career of producer Dan Fogelman, who has now added a big screen credit, the Amazon Studios film Life Itself. Starring A-list actors such as Oscar Isaac, Olivia Wilde, Annette Bening, Mandy Patinkin, Laia Costa, and Antonio Banderas, the film follows a young couple's journey from college romance to marriage and the twists of their life that impact generations and strangers from afar.
But the film has not generated the same kind of success as Fogelman's TV work. It scored only an 11% on the review site Rotten Tomatoes, and its opening weekend box office take was the worst opening of any widely released film this year, just $2.5 million.
It's sobering news for a studio that wants to start generating more of its own content. Amazon Studios has generated plenty of critical successes, but is Life Itself a bad indicator of the work that still needs to be done? Well, film contributor Dave Larson says that while Life Itself is not the greatest movie of the year, the scale of the critical negativity is puzzling.
It's rare for the Rotten Tomatoes crowd to lob consistently bad reviews at any movie. But for once, the Aggregated Critics Association is hurling abuse with one mind, giving Life Itself a rotten 13% positive rating. Given the free passes many of them consistently give to mediocre Hollywood product, the scale of their peevishness is puzzling. Life Itself won't be the greatest movie any of us will see this year, but it's far from the worst as it cleverly zigzags through the stories we tell to and about ourselves. And it has an A-list cast that rises to their roles.
So does this film show the TV background of writer and director Dan Fogelman in a flattering or unflattering way?
Well, I think in a flattering way, actually. He's playing with the medium of motion pictures and of storytelling itself. So, I came in with a negative impression based upon glancing at some of the stuff that's out there already before the release of the movie. And maybe that low expectation helped me, but I found myself enjoying the movie for the most part.
Yeah, and it was ultimately a film in its long format, but it was also broken up into chapters, which at first I thought, well, maybe this shows not very strong screenwriting for a TV producer who can't tie it in all together, but do you think this overall helped tie together these different narratives that are interconnected?
Well, many films over the years have gone with the chapter format also, so it's not a breakthrough and it's not necessarily peculiar to TV screenwriting. I think he tied the stories together. I mean, there have been many movies in the past that try to look at the way that widely separated people can impact the lives of others, and this movie does a little bit of that also. So again, nothing new there in a cinematic sense. But, I think he handled the material he created well. One of the things that I kept thinking about was in terms of the dialogue. you know, maybe people in real life are beginning to talk like TV sitcoms and TV dramas. I mean, art or entertainment imitates life, life imitates that, and maybe some of that is going on here in this film.
Right. And with the cast and crew, we have really strong actors behind this. We have Oscar Isaac, Olivia Wilde, Annette Bening, Mandy Patinkin, Laia Costa, Antonio Banderas, to name a few. Do you think this would deliver as well had it been any other casting or more mediocre actors compared to these A-listers?
No, it would not have, because
maybe get a 7% review instead of 13%.
It would have dropped on Rotten Tomatoes even more. I think that, you know, even great screenwriting can be brought down by mediocre actors. One of the problems I have with many TV shows that I watch is whether it's the mediocrity of the acting or the rush job of producing a series in a hurry, not enough time to rehearse, not enough time to think about what you're doing. The direction has to be kind of slam bang, and sometimes that works. But often you really do get the impression in comparing TV actors in some series to film actors and in good movies, at least, like, you know, there is really something you can see here that's different between the two of them. And I don't think it's simply that people in TV are bad actors. They didn't, you know, take their college acting training seriously enough. I think that has to do with the production process of that particular medium versus the way films are normally made.
So with this film medium for Dan Fogelman, obviously we're able to go into darker territory. You know, had this been made for TV, I don't think the themes would have been as dark. I mean, there probably would have been just as many deaths, but not the same way of showing them. Do you think this was an advantage to him?
Well, yes. I mean, his background, I think, is in networked broadcasting, where there are still many, many things that can't be done. If this had been done for cable or done simply for streaming, for Amazon, I don't know that there would have necessarily been much difference as far as that goes, because what are the restrictions on, you know, internet TV, or whatever the best term for these things would be these days? You can pretty much do whatever you want to do. I mean, it's assumed that a mature audience of people are making choices.
So we have about four chapters in this film bouncing between various families and generations. And ultimately, the theme of an unreliable narrator is, I don't want to say bludgeoned throughout, but the point is made clear in case you missed it with any other scenarios. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is just an attempt to hit the writing home or hit the theme home, or just to make sure audiences get a point?
Well, maybe the bludgeoning aspect of it is a symptom of Fogelman's background in TV, where you maybe can't count on especially a network TV audience and getting sophisticated references. You know, maybe if he had been an indie filmmaker, you know, Coen Brothers type of people with a background in philosophy in college, maybe it would have been less bludgeoned, but it could have still been there, because I think it is an important part of what this film is trying to tell us. That what is it that we know about other people? It's usually what other people tell us about other people, or tell us about themselves. And what do we know about ourselves? We make up stories about ourselves to ourselves, many of us do anyway, that explain who we are to ourselves, because who we are, you know, might be just too vast. We contain multitudes, like Walt Whitman said of himself. I mean, it's, you know, we do these things. We are a narrative-creating species because it helps us navigate through a reality that's incomprehensible at times.
And also the purpose of movie is to add to or escape these narratives and realities. And what Amazon is trying to do, especially with this film, is appeal to the masses. You know, they're moving away from buying art films, making them for distribution. And this movie, obviously, I think, will definitely rely on the popularity of Fogelman's show, This Is Us. Did this miss the mark, or was it filled with elements audience of the TV show already love and will automatically flock to the movies to see whether this has a 13% rating or not?
Well, I think the movie will at least do modestly well, and I'm judging this based upon the advanced screening public audience that I saw it with, who laughed at the jokes and seemed to appreciate the movie. Whenever there's a comedy and I'm sitting there and nobody else is laughing, I have a pretty good feeling that this is going to fail. I think that people got the humor. I think that the movie veers between humor and horror quite a bit. I mean, terrible things happen, funny things happen. Terrible things are put into amusing contexts, only to be flipped into a different kind of context again. So I think it'll be fine. I think it'll be carried both by the popularity of Fogelman's TV work, but also by the cast, which will draw, you know, other people into the theaters.
Well, and this was most likely a relatively low risk project to underwrite because, just based on the needs of the film, you have two primary locations, but it's not a big budget action thriller type thing for Amazon to worry about, will it make its money back?
Well, there aren't planets to destroy and galaxies to obliterate and superheroes to put convincingly into midair combating one another. No, it's a people character story driven film. Probably the biggest part of the budget may very well be the cast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, getting into the whole Amazon studio thing, they certainly do want to make a good impression by hiring the best, if you will.
Exactly. Amazon Studios is currently under relatively new leadership, Jennifer Skalke, and she is the head of the studios, and she has emphasized that they want quality over volume. And while that may be the case, certainly compared to Netflix's rate of production, whether it comes from original TV or movie series on Netflix, do you see Amazon able to accomplish this goal while keeping the focus on that? Or do you think it has too many pots on the stove, so to speak, to be able to have a reputable standalone film company while its interest is ultimately going to be in customers coming over to Amazon Prime to ultimately buy product?
Well, the ultimate cross-marketing experience. Again, this is not unprecedented because as far back as the 1970s, the old Hollywood studios were mostly purchased by transnational corporations that had nothing to do with the entertainment business. And these were prestige projects, owning MGM Studio or Warner Brothers or whatever it may have been at that time. And, you know, the film industry has always been, from the very beginning, you know, geared toward a contradictory impulse between quality and quantity, getting back to, I guess, her terminology. The idea of film as an art form was there from very early on, but also the idea of film as show business was there right from the get-go. So can you do both? Yeah, I mean, obviously, Hollywood at its best has done both things consistently. So in a way, Amazon Studio is not anything new. Again, it's a prestige project by a gigantic entity out there that doesn't need to do a film studio. But so why would they want to get into it? Because there is risk involved in making movies, especially if you do get into superhero movies or stuff of that type that will cost a lot more money to make. You could lose a lot of money on the gambling on something that's not going to work out. There still is something very prestigious about owning a movie studio and producing movies, and I think that maybe this appeals to the upper-level management of Amazon on some level. Amazon also is rumored to be thinking of purchasing the Landmark Theaters chain. So they want to do it all. They want to have streaming. They want to have brick-and-mortar movie theaters. They want to produce not only their own television series, but movies. And again, we could talk for hours about the distinction between TV and movies nowadays. It's blurring together as people are watching things in a variety of formats, and people are going very easily between one aspect of that and another. So I think Amazon, maybe because of what they are, they are uniquely situated to take advantage of all of this.
And they are positioning themselves to have more control over content. In April of this year, it announced that they're no longer accepting open submissions of screenplays. So that's vastly different between, you know, its start. One of its biggest successes was buying Manchester by the Sea at Sundance for $10 million, which went on to win two Oscars. You know, it has Transparent, which also won a Golden Globe, which was the first show produced by streaming media to get that. So do you think it's definitely showing its intention of distinguishing itself, or do you think it also kind of takes away the democracy or the fun of being able to say you're a screenwriter somewhere who doesn't have access to Hollywood studios to be able to have a chance of sending something to Amazon to get picked up? And that was part of its art house appeal. And now it's trying to control more of that content.
Well, that might have been a one in a billion chance of getting your screenplay
right.
produced by Amazon with a nice bit of hype, I think, on their part. And no, I'm not surprised that they're going a more traditional route. And again, the whole indie filmmaking thing, yes, there are genuine indie filmmakers, but even what that meant got pretty blurry after a point because most people who originate as indie filmmakers end up working in tandem with the movie industry in some way, shape, or form. So again, nothing earth-shatteringly different about any of this. It's just that Amazon has become this gigantic entity. Its tentacles wrapped around the globe ever more tightly. And why should we be surprised that they'd be interested in filmmaking? I mean, what, you know, it still is, and ties in with the theme of this movie, life itself. It's a way that people tell stories or see stories about the world, a way that people can try to make sense of the world we live in and of ourselves, and we look at characters on screen and maybe we try to relate ourselves to them. Many people end up consciously or not emulating the characters we see on screen. So it just is a very natural transition for Amazon to make.
All right, Dave. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dave Lurson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express and a regular Lake Effect film contributor. He is one of our film contributors. We hope you are one of our sustaining contributors or sustaining members who are making our fall member drive a rousing success. We are into day two of the fall member drive. This show and many others on this station are made possible by listener support. So we hope that you'll be one of those listeners that contributes. 414-227-3210 or visit us online at wuwm.com/give. And we have an extra special incentive this hour only.
That's right. Today and today only during this hour of Lake Effect, anyone who contributes is automatically entered to win a 3-book collection of biographies that have been featured here on Lake Effect. And while a contribution is not required to enter the drawing, it's of course greatly appreciated because also this hour we're looking to have 10 new sustaining members added to our list. And it's the public in public radio that we're looking for. It's you guys who listen to Lake Effect Here and Now, Morning Edition. If NPR is a regular part of your day, we ask you to consider perhaps putting a monetary value on that. It doesn't have to be a massive significant number. It could be that $5 fancy latte you get during the week. And instead, it's put towards public radio worth listening to. So if you call 227-3210 or go online to wuwm.com/give, you can choose the level that's best appropriate for you. And we look forward to seeing your name on that membership list.
Right. And, you know, think about over the course of a morning where you hear, you know, experts, guests from across the board. You know, you could be hearing from people anywhere and everywhere on Morning Edition and then on the BBC World Service at 9 o'clock. You hear guests from both a national and a local standpoint right here on Lake Effect. And then we go on to Fresh Air, which has luminaries from many different fields. They're all in this one place. And, you know, we don't ask you to support everything. We don't ask you to cover the whole bill. But how about playing a role in keeping this show and the others that you hear each and every day healthy? Call us now, 414-227-3210 with your support or visit us online at wuwm.com/give.
Yeah, perhaps you can use that ticket money towards life itself and instead put it towards public radio
exactly.
Based on what's happened. But we're going to take another quick break and then the efforts of a Milwaukee actor to bring attention to the work of writer, poet, and editor, a former Milwaukeean, Carl Sandburg. We'll hear that when Lake Effect returns here on listener-supported WUWM.
Way down upon the Wabash, such land was never known. If Adam had passed over it, the soil he'd surely own.
He'd think it was the garden.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Carl Sandburg was a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, poet, and editor. And while he's considered to be one of the major figures of contemporary literature, his specific works are not as well known as those of other literary luminaries. One Milwaukee actor wants to change that with his one-man show, The Eagle in Me.
Created by Jonathan Daly, the show recreates Sandburg's own traveling show that journeyed through the heart of America, showcasing his poetry and his vast collection of American folk songs.
Sandburg himself had ties to Milwaukee. Moving to the city after college, he worked as an advertising writer and newspaper reporter. He married a Milwaukee woman and even worked under the first socialist mayor of Milwaukee from 1910 to 1912.
These many talents and aspects of his life always piqued Daly's interest in Sandburg, and he tells Bonnie North on site at the In Tandem Theater what it was about Sandburg's body of work that inspired him to create a one-man show.
I first got interested in the guy when I was 25. I was working at a story theater company in St. Louis. And our whole thing was, it was all theater for young audiences. And the whole thing was about finding pieces of literature written for young people by great authors, you know, as a way to get people, get kids interested in reading. Say, well, if you liked this, what we just did, you can find it in your library. And we found, you know, there were writers like Oscar Wilde and Ray Bradbury and Guy de Maupassant, all these great writers who actually wrote for young people.
I'm in shock with Oscar Wilde.
Oscar Wilde, oh, The Happy Prince. What a great, great story for kids. Anyway, one of the writers that we discovered was Carl Sandburg, that he had written a whole lot of stories for kids. I later found out that it was part of a series called the Rutabaga Stories, which was a two-volume set of stories that he wrote, mostly inspired by his daughters in the 1920s. I loved those stories so much. They were a go-to thing for us. They always worked. And that got me just interested in learning more about him. And then, of course, that led me to, oh, my gosh, he didn't just write stories for kids. He was a historian. He wrote a two-volume biography of Abraham Lincoln. He wrote hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of poems. Everybody, you know, hears The Fog when they're kids, at least when I was a kid. That was the thing that, you know, you learned about Carl Sandburg, was that he wrote The Fog. But he had this amazing body of work. And then I found out that in the middle of his career, he needed to make money because two of his kids had chronic illnesses. And so he decided to hit the road. He had played guitar very rudimentary all his life. He learned four chords when he was 10, and he never felt a pressing need to learn any more. But he would sing these. He had collected folk music into a book called The American Song Bag in the 1920s. And he started traveling all over the country with his guitar, playing folk music that he researched himself, and reciting his poetry and telling some stories and talking about his life. And he became a real entertainer all across the United States for a good 15 or 20 years. And lots and lots of people went to see Carl Sandburg when they were kids.
That's so interesting because I think, of course, of Mark Twain doing that, the barnstorming tours. Mm-hmm. And then a little later, I think of Woody Guthrie doing that sort of thing. I never knew that about Carl Sandburg.
Yeah, yeah. And when I discovered that, I thought, well, this is perfect. Someday I should really do this. This would be fun to do. Not necessarily kind of doing the Hal Holbrook thing of putting on the makeup and putting on the costume and being Carl Sandburg, but just I just always thought it would be fun to reveal Carl Sandburg, especially after, I mean, he died in 1967, and anybody who's under the age of 40 doesn't know who he is. It is, for some reason, his memory has not passed on into this century. And so he's a real blank slate for a lot of people. So I thought it would be great to just kind of not imitate him, but imitate that style and reveal this man through his own words. Thing about what I'm doing is I'd say it's 85% to 90% all Carl Sandburg. The only stuff I've added is when I need little segues to go from one piece to another, and I really try to write it in his style. But he left so much, so there's plenty of material. I don't need to create anything. All I'm doing is arranging it so that people get to know the guy.
What was it about his style of writing? Do you think it was approachable? Is that why people liked it so much? What distinguishes it?
You know, I think at the time he was really a experimenter. He would never say that, but in blank verse, the stuff he wrote about was everyday stuff about cities and dirt and dust and working people and war and just real, you know, down in the dirt kind of stuff. It was a real response or a contrast from the romantic poetry that had preceded in the 1880s, 1890s. So he was kind of a new voice. And a lot of critics at the time said, well, he's not really a poet because he's writing this stuff isn't poetry. This stuff doesn't
rhyme.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So he was a real different voice at that period of time. And I think that really appealed to people. He was the poet of the people. That was kind of the way people thought of him, that even if you didn't read poetry, even if you didn't understand poetry, if you go and if you listen to Carl Sandburg read his poetry, or if you read it yourself, you're going to discover that you actually do like poetry.
Can you recite The Fog?
Oh, sure, The Fog. Well, that's a little tiny poem. The fog comes in on little cat feet. It sits looking over harbor and city on silent haunches and then moves on.
That's Which it. Is such a great...
little haiku.
I know.
And I'll scoop a little bit. In this evening, I also I recite his daughter's version. His daughters, who were little kids at the time, wrote their own version of The Fog. The fog blow in on itty-bitty-kitty footsies. It sits on Chicago and then whammo.
That's great.
That's just love.
Whammo.
Whammo.
There's a word you don't hear anymore.
Yeah.
Well, you are sitting here not only talking to me about Carl Sandburg, but you have a guitar.
Believe
in
it or
your
not.
Hands.
I know. There it is.
And you're not claiming to be a guitarist, but are you going to be singing in this? I'm assuming yes.
Indeed. The great thing about this with the music, I mean, he loved music so much, but as he said himself, he picked up his first guitar at 12 and he learned four chords on it and never felt a pressing need to learn any more. So.
Everything's in one key.
It's all in one key. It's all real simple, and that it does me just fine. So I, well, here's one. This is a song that he kind of popularized at the time. He collected folk music. He spent just years compiling this classic book called American Song Bag that became kind of the Bible for folk music because he collected stuff from all the way back to the Revolutionary times and up to the present time at the time, 1923.
So was he working with Alan Lomax at all? Because that was about the same time.
Yeah, about the same time. Yeah, I mean, he collected it from everybody. He invited everybody that he could find to submit things, all kinds of, I mean, literary figures and folk music artists, and he just, it was an exhaustive thing. I mean, there are hundreds of songs in this book. It became this source that Pete Seeger really kind of popularized it because he took from it very liberally because Sandburg had dug up all this wonderful stuff that nobody knew about. And one of these things is a song that he used to associate with his wife, Paula, that he met in 1903, and they stayed married for until his death in 1967.
Love, oh love, oh careless love. Love, oh careless love. It's love, oh, careless love. Won't you see what your love has done for me? Oh, I love my mama and my papa too. I love my mama and my papa too. Oh, I love my mama and my papa too. But I'd leave them both to go with you.
I had no idea that he had popularized that because, of course, that's such – I mean, it's been played in bluegrass circles forever. I mean, it's one of those songs that you just sort of – is in the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was really big on – he collected a lot of John Henry songs. Let's see, how does that go? Let's see. They took John Henry to the steep hillside. He looked to the heaven above. He said, pick my hammer and wrap it in gold and give it to the girl I love. Oh, give it to the girl I love. He said, if I die a railroad man, go bury me under the tie so I can hear old number four as she goes rolling by. As she goes rolling by. There are millions of John Henry songs, and he found a lot of them.
Well, and of course, you mentioned Pete Seeger, and I can hear Pete Seeger with a banjo doing just that. Mm-hmm. You know, in my as you're singing the song, it's like, well, yeah, that's what we all heard it was from Pete Seeger, probably.
Yeah, I took there's a little nod to Pete Seeger in the show because I take one little segue. This is not something from the American Songbag. It was a song that you associate with Pete Seeger. Oh, what did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? Oh, what did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned George Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free, and that's what the teacher said to me. That's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. I just kind of pretend that, you know, Carl inspired that. But.
Well, he probably would have.
He would have loved it. Yeah,
I think he would have.
Yeah.
So what do you hope that people get from this show? I mean, just a new appreciation of Sandberg?
That, among other things. The thing that's amazing, and I'm hoping that the more I do this story, the more I tell this, the more it's going to be revealed that one of the things that was just extraordinary about Carl Sandburg, besides his incredible talent and his writing, is that he was a man who was in the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s, he was not afraid to speak his mind. He was a very politically active person. And the thing that's amazing about him is that he never ran afoul of Joe McCarthy in the 1950s, even though he was a steadfast opponent of war. When things were going on in the country that he didn't like, he spoke up about it. And yet he endeared himself to people of all political points of view. He was a guy that just transcended partisanship. Which at that time, when you consider, I mean, we think we're in a polarizing time now. The time that he was living in was equally polarizing, and he actually was beloved by people from the right and from the left. He was able to ride that rail, and that I think that makes him really an extraordinary person.
What do you think he could?
In his writing, in his poetry, he was able to convey how much he loved this country. No matter what, I mean, it wasn't my country right or wrong. It was my country is wrong here, but I love it anyway. And the fact that he was able to do that, I think, is a real important thing for people to hear now. And I have a feeling it's going to get more and more important the longer I do this work.
So this is opening at In Tandem. Mm-hmm. Do you have hopes once that run is over of taking it on the road,
just
like Carl?
Yeah. Yeah, just like Carl.
Yeah.
I would really like to – I think I would like to do a lot of one-night stands. I'd like to take it – I think it would be a great thing to put on college campuses, again, for people who don't know anything about him, to learn about him. It may not be the kind of thing that goes from I'm a regional theater actor, and it may not go from regional theater to regional theater but maybe. I really have high hopes to take this thing all over the place. And not necessarily into theaters, into community centers, into the kind of thing that he would do.
Coffee shops.
He played everywhere from Carnegie Hall to people's living rooms and opera houses and community centers and churches. And I would love to do that kind of thing. The great thing about Jane and Chris and In Tandem is that they're giving me an opportunity to get this thing off the ground with 23 performances. So I'm going to learn so much about this work. Which I know is going to be a constant work in progress because I'll be adding and subtracting things my whole life with this work, but to give it this kind of good focused sit down run for 23 performances is just a huge gift, and I am thankful every single moment that I'm getting the chance to do this.
And I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Thank you so much for the preview today, Jonathan.
You
I really
bet.
Appreciate it. You and break a leg.
Thank you very much.
The Eagle in Me, An Evening of Carl Sandburg, is written and starring actor Jonathan Gillard Daly. The play has its world premiere this Thursday evening at In Tandem Theater Company, and you can find a link to more information at WUWM.com. And that is also where you'll find information on our fall membership drive. Here we are on day two. And in this hour of Lake Effect, we're looking for 10 new members, and with your help, I know we could reach that goal. And also today, and today only during this hour, if you contribute, you are automatically entered to win a 3-book collection of biographies that have been featured here on Lake Effect. And much like learning new things about Carl Sandburg, you know, these books that we read and interview authors about really let us learn something new every day. I mean,
it is
I can
really
say working
of, yeah.
here, that's what you get. You learn something new.
Right. Sometimes doing this show or doing interviews is a little like writing a term paper every day or having homework every day. But at the same time, it's also like our own personal maybe MFA work or our own personal, you know, work towards a history degree or something like that. It's really kind of amazing the kind of stuff that we get to learn from our interview guests. And we hope we impart to you as well. When you listen to Lake Effect, you learn something that maybe you didn't know at the beginning of the day, something you can bring up when you're, you know, at a do people go to cocktail parties anymore? Are there, we always bring up the example of cocktail parties, and I don't remember the last time I mentioned something at a cocktail party, but certainly at the bus stop.
At the bus stop, at the line in the coffee shop, perhaps at the gym. You know, anywhere that you are standing around waiting.
Pumping iron and talking about Carl Sandburg.
Exactly. You know, if you need motivation, you just think about all his life accomplishments. You do one more set of reps. But yeah, I can always say that learning something new, especially when it comes to Milwaukee or Wisconsin-centric things, like you don't realize, you know, perhaps we have a slight inferiority complex when it comes to a lot of things, but a lot of talented people and events and things happened here, as demonstrated by Mayan Silver, her interview about the Milwaukee 14, and what we just learned about Carl Sandburg, and that in turn getting turned into a play and music.
Well, and you know, the other thing that really sets Milwaukeeans apart, their support for public radio.
That's right.
And they do that by calling 414-227-3210 or visiting us at WUWM.com/give and helping us reach our goal of 10 new members during Lake Effect. And thank you so much. That wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks again for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.